in having the community radio. These are people part of the communities, so they trust them more than anyone else who would come with tape recorders. So it's very easy to give them news, even their top secrets.
Wow. What is this we're passing?
Oh, it's a Catholic thing. It's a sacrament.
So do these folks listen to Radio Izuba?
Yeah, we can ask them.
Pardon.
Ah.
they like it because it belongs to them. It's radio proximity. They also like Mseke Weya. It's a program about reconciliation. There's one guy called Rutaganya. He was a leader whereby he was mobilizing the citizens to go and kill their neighbors. Now he's saying that it's not good to mobilize people to kill their neighbors.
And he heard that on this program?
Mseke Weya.
In the shade of a rural settlement not far from the border with Burundi, 100 men and women have gathered for Gachacha, a traditional village court for local genocide cases. A woman is testifying about the murder of her young son, a Tutsi. The woman's mother, the boy's grandmother, was one of those who turned him in for slaughter. Clement Kirenga and other Izuba folks are here, reporting. The crowd is aware of their presence.
It's like a habit now. People don't talk. They don't testify on what their role in genocide. But when the radio gets there, they say, okay, today I'm going to talk just because the radio is here. I know I can't be victimized. So both sides were like, they were happy about the presence of the radio.
Radio Izuba is here too, a genocide remembrance ceremony.
Where we are now, just a few meters away, there is a site where there's buried 500 people that were perished in 1994 genocide. So the role of Radio Izuba is to broadcast the testimonies of the survivors in order to know that genocide happened and it will never happen again.
I record a bit, then switch my recorder off. Within seconds, the woman sitting in front of me, possessed by the demons of rape and murder, erupts into hysterics. A group of men carry her off, her arms and legs flailing. Then another woman loses it. She's carried out, too.
When you just read the history of Rwanda, it was quite distorted, and that is why genocide occurred in this country. So when you put the history of Rwanda in its proper context, you are trying to bridge that gap between the Hutus and Tutsis. In reality, they had no great differences, and so there was no need of conflict and fighting that ended up in genocide.
I like that idea that, well, you can call me and tell me what you're thinking, and then we can have a national debate about it. And while we're having that debate, everyone else can listen in, and there's a sort of something that connects us all through radio.
Hate radio changed Rwanda forever. Never had the media been used so effectively to poison people's minds and get them to kill. Today, Rwandan broadcasters use many of the same tricks, either to mobilize for peace or simply to entertain, banishing the spirits of those awful 100 days. Read more about Rwanda's 100-day genocide at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, click on that subscription box. You'll be helping to make this weekly news package happen. Drones. Every country wants a fleet of them, packed with sensors, cameras, and missiles. Small ones that loiter, drop tear gas or bombs, or crash with a big bang. Big ones that fire missiles, all on command from control rooms hundreds, if not thousands, of kilometers away. Now, Canada is in the market for a fleet of its own. Hellfire missiles and laser-guided bombs may be on its shopping list. In 2019, Canada sent an invitation to qualify to two companies, U.S. weapons firm General Atomics, with its MQ-9B Sky Guardian, a variant of the Reaper, and Quebec-based L3 Technologies, manufacturer of Heron drones, on license to Israeli Aircraft Industries. A formal request for proposals was issued to the two in February of 2022. Lots of countries produce drones. None have more experience field testing them on defenseless populations than the Israelis. As it happens, Israeli drones may now be out of the running. With me to talk about Canada's planned acquisition of a fleet of potentially armed drones is Branka Marianne, a senior researcher at Project Plowshares, one of Canada's oldest arms control and disarmament NGOs. So these armed drones, the Canadian government said that it was going to be putting out a call for proposals for these armed drones back in February of 2022. So where does this stand at the moment?
Okay, so we're now at the point where there are two companies that they're looking to acquire the drones from. These are supposed to be the first drones are supposed to be delivered within the 2025 initially, but 2026 timeframe, and then sort of having a fully operational fleet by 2030. So right now we're at the stage where they're still selecting which of the two companies essentially they're going to go with. They could still go with another supplier, but I think generally we're looking at these two companies. The Heron drone is one that's familiar to the Canadian Armed Forces because these were leased by the Canadian Armed Forces in Afghanistan. What we're talking about are essentially medium altitude, right, drones that can be armed or do not necessarily need to be armed. And these can be used for surveillance purposes, right, but they can also then be used to strike targets if they're, equipped with weapons of different types. And there's been interest in equipping these with Hellfire missiles and laser-guided bombs. So essentially, the Canadian government is, or DND, is looking at using these drones for a variety of purposes. We've just sort of had some insight into how they're thinking about these over the last few years, including everything from surveillance of the Arctic, for example, but also they do actually want to see them armed, right? I think it was the former General Vance who said, you know, what's the point of essentially having these drones if they're not armed or we don't have the ability to arm them? And this is a part of a global trend, right? Over 100 countries have access to drones, usually for ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance purposes. And, you know, a subset of those have access to armed drones. And now with sort of developments, global geopolitical developments and conflicts that we're seeing both now in Ukraine and previously in Nagorno-Karabakh, there is sort of the perception that states need access to armed drones, to loitering munitions, and that's very much about sort of increasing access to air power for smaller and, you know, medium states as well.
Did you say loitering munitions?
Loitering munitions, yeah. Loitering munitions are sometimes called kamikaze drones because they explode upon impact. So they can loiter, depending on the type of munition it is, can loiter in an area for hours, and then they will strike a target. So what separates them from a drone essentially is that, you know, these are munitions, they will explode upon impact, whereas drones, of course, have payloads that they can, or weapons essentially, that they can get rid of.
So the loitering drone would circle around and then it would actually fly in and attack a target.
Absolutely, exactly.
And get destroyed in the process versus an armed drone that would fire a Hellfire missile.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. That's the difference between the loitering munitions and kamikaze drones and then the armed drones. And increasingly, the loitering munitions are equipped with better sensor technology. And what we've seen, for example, in Libya, was the use of this Turkish loitering munition, which apparently had artificial intelligence included in its capabilities, and for example, facial recognition technology, which was then claimed that this drone was used for what was used somewhat autonomously, right? So that increasingly, it's not just that we have these platforms, it's that they are now being equipped with better sensor technology and with artificial intelligence, allowing them to function to even more autonomously.
So who are these two companies again? Who are they?
The two key companies that Canada is looking to is L3 Technologies and General Atomics, right? Which L3 proposed the Heron drone from the Israeli aircraft industries, while we're looking at General Atomics, which has proposed the it's a U.S. company, MQ-9B Sky Guardian, which is, if you have, you know, ever come across the Reaper or the Predator drones, that the Sky Guardian is essentially kind of a successor to those platforms.
And then the other company, did you say the other company is Israeli?
No, it's L3 Technologies, which has proposed the Heron drone from the Israeli aircraft industries. The Heron drone is the one that was used by the Canadian Armed Forces previously in Afghanistan. At that time, it was used for surveillance purposes and was not used to carry weapons. The Heron is one that Canadians have because they've leased it previously in Afghanistan, right? They have some familiarity with it, and it has features that make it sort of, from the military perspective, sort of suitable for, you know, what they were sort of saying is the primary function, which would be ISR, surveillance purposes, right? Because it can stay up in the air for, you know, something like they claim over 50 hours. And so they have different sort of functionalities that appeal to D&D. We haven't gotten a sense yet of sort of which company they're likely to go with. And indeed, despite this sort of being a long process, I mean, wish for Canada to acquire armed drones or drones in general, and then subsequently armed drones, you know, it's been decades in the making, right? There's expressed interest in the early 2000s, and then obviously with the use of the surveillance drones in Afghanistan. And now we're at the point where they're kind of moving forward with this process. But it's something that's been, you know, an ongoing, long-standing, decade-long process.
How transparent is the acquisition process?
This whole process hasn't been very transparent, and there also hasn't been sufficient information. I mean, you know, these scenarios that were accessed and, you know, highlighted the use of drones for some, the sort of the, yeah, the wish to use the drones for surveillance in the Arctic. We don't have a sense of sort of the ways in which, you know, the CAF is thinking or the Royal Canadian Air Force is thinking of using the drones, what kind of sort of scenarios really are they sort of envisioning. You know, they say we're, of course, going to abide by international humanitarian law or the law of war, and which, you know, which is excellent and important. But we still haven't gotten a sense of where does this, the drone program, fit in to the broader sort of approach of CAF and DND. And we just don't have that kind of information. So everything about the acquisition process, the, you know, the sort of the perceived uses of these systems, all of that is has been very, I would say, difficult to get access to information regarding it. Mainly, I think what we're seeing is our sort of snippets and bits of information and some briefings that, you know, journalists have gotten access to. Generally, we haven't had an open discussion or debate in Canada that we've seen in other places, right, regarding the acquiring of armed drones. I don't think there was, you know, a wide enough discussion of some of the scenarios, because they did say, you know, feature sort of drones being used for surveillance of protests domestically, right, which are, you know, very problematic uses of these platforms and, you know, and impacts on our human rights. But again, there hasn't been a wide enough debate. So these are just scenarios that are proposed, but we don't have a, you know, that are proposed, but we don't have a sense of, is this really how, you know, CAF and DND are envisioning these uses? And, you know, what are some of the sort of, yeah, of the restrictions they envision or norms or regulations that they sort of, or codes of conduct? We don't have a sense of that. And again, I'm stressing that we just haven't had an open debate at a national level in Canada, like we've seen in countries like Germany, right? And so everything that we're getting are these snippets of information, potential scenarios, potential uses, but none of that, I think, is sufficient, right? We need a much broader discussion with a greater deal of clarity, so that we have, you know, really useful information, and a greater deal, of course, of transparency regarding that.
And what are Project Plowshares' principal concerns about the acquisition by Canadian National Defence of drones, certainly of armed drones? What's your problem with drones?
Yeah, I think what we just would like to have is more information in terms of how are these systems going to be used, for what purposes. We just need more information. I think the concerns there really are we going to see, you know, these drones surveilling domestic protests? I mean, that's really problematic from our perspective. And then if we're saying, you know, there is some scenarios that were presented that envision these drones being used for what the United States has done with the signature strikes, right, which are, these are targeting of particular individuals. What we're seeing, certainly globally, because there is a lack of a framework internationally for regulating armed drones, you know, what we're seeing is the use of these systems in non-conflict contexts, right? So the worry there is that we're kind of expanding the use of these systems around the world with sort of a real lack of transparency regarding their use.
And what they really are used, we've seen them used in the past as vehicles for carrying out extrajudicial assassinations, under, obviously, by the very nature of such operations, they are highly secretive. They're planned and organized and executed from tightly controlled control centers, like the basement of the White House or some facility in Nevada where somebody's playing with their joystick.
and executes somebody in a car, it's an extrajudicial assassination.
Absolutely. So the concern is that, you know, you see those kinds of events, and then you also see an impact on civilians and civilian populations. And I would say that's our primary concern. It is the impact on the civilian populations, because there have been quite a few, you know, famous or infamous, I should say, instances where these signature strikes, these, you know, strikes on these high value targets essentially end up targeting individuals that had nothing to do, you know, with that particular individual that's being sought. Or, you know, there's been cases of sort of mistaken identity kind of. And that's, I think, where we're primarily concerned, because it does, we have seen a significant impact on the civilian populations in places where these programs have been sort of rolled out. And I think that's, we'd like just a lot more clarity and information from DNDCAF, how they envision these systems, and ultimately using these systems, and ultimately having specific, I think, you know, regulations guiding different uses. I think for surveillance and reconnaissance purposes, if we're talking about, you know, the Arctic, and, you know, that some of those purposes can seem somewhat more acceptable. But then if we think of surveilling domestic protests, I think generally the Canadian population would be very uncomfortable with that. And I think rightly so, because there are, of course, human rights implications.
And surveilling protests and dropping rounds of tear gas, which is, of course, what Israeli drones do routinely over places like Gaza.
Absolutely. So, I mean, these are, you know, sometimes I think in Canada we suffer a bit from this perception that things like that could never happen here. And I think the challenge really is to highlight that these are very concerning uses of these systems that we've seen already in different countries and in different places. And it does not mean that we're somehow immune to these, you know, sometimes perhaps misuses. And so I think we need to be very vigilant as civil society in Canada about sort of the types of systems that are deployed and used and what becomes acceptable, right? And I think there is a level of acceptance of drones globally, you know, really where it's become sort of normalized for militaries to have access to these systems. And as I outlined, I mean, over 100 countries use them, right? For, you know, mostly for surveillance, but there is a wider number of countries that now have access to armed drones. And we're looking at countries that are quite willing to export some of these systems, right? Like Turkey and Iran. And China, of course, is a big exporter of these systems. So what you're seeing globally is a normalization of how these systems function and their capabilities. And so I think we have to be very thoughtful domestically as well, both in terms of how, you know, these systems would be used in different places by CAF and DND, but also how they would be used domestically. And we see this with new technologies in general. I mean, it's a pattern that's repeating of already overly policed, already sort of discriminated against populations being targeted once again with the new technologies, whether it's, you know, the use of AI in policing, whether it's, you know, on the surveillance in terms of the surveillance drones, for example. There's, you know, the protests in the United States that happened following the death of George Floyd. You know, really we saw the deployment of these drones to surveil those protests. And I think that should be sort of a wake-up call for Canadians that, you know, even in a democratic society, some of these systems can be used or have been used to really, I think, put a bit of a curb on some of our human rights.
How much would this procurement cost?
So I believe the estimate is about $5 billion.
$5 billion.
Yeah, this is a $5 billion contract.
To procure a fleet of two dozen drones?
They never specified the number. It was left up to the companies to present the best kind of bid. And so, yeah, it's not an insignificant amount of money. I think it's fair to say that.
Branka Marianne, can Canada do without drones, armed or unarmed, in Project Plowshares' view? Can we just say, it's a great idea, but let's not do it? We do not need certainly armed drones, perhaps surveillance drones, you know, surveilling the Arctic, looking for people who are lost. But do we need armed drones, weaponized drones?
I think I can only speak in my name, but I would say it's a really challenging global environment. And there is a perception that these systems are absolutely critical to militaries, to modern militaries. And another challenge that the Canadian forces are facing, of course, is recruitment of, you know, individuals who are, you know, knowledgeable and experienced to fly some of these platforms. And they're experiencing that in terms of other sort of manned platforms. And so there's an appeal of these, right, uncrewed aircraft, because they do sort of amplify your air power as a smaller or middle power state. But I really am reticent about the sort of the use of armed drones, and particularly the scenarios which outline essentially what would be signature strikes. I think that's really concerning. And I think we need much more information and a better sense. I mean, we need a national debate whether, you know, this is something that we'd like to see Canada do, and whether we want Canada's armed forces to, you know, have these armed drones. I think where we are in the process with, you know, the sort of this contract, it seems very likely that Canada is going to get armed drones. So I think at this point, we need to be thoughtful about what are we sort of asking for and in terms of how these systems will be used.
Branka Marianne, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure.
Branka Marianne is a senior researcher at Canadian NGO Project Plowshares. Read more about Canada's planned acquisition of armed drones at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and the Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of a community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
Radio Rewind.